Welcome to the NZ Tech Podcast.
It's the Christmas special.
And episode 46.
Yes, it's all about Christmas tonight and the good old gadgets that Santa's going to bring us.
Yep, we've got a whole lot lined up for you, so sit tight, listen in, and yeah, let's jump into it, guys. Well, this evening, there's myself, Paul Spain, in the studio. We have our special guest with us.
Simon Gamble from Mako Networks.
Welcome aboard.
You got Bradley Burrows and you got Skip Parker managing the sound desk for us, and we'll hopefully chuck a mic to him at some point.
All right, so we've got a whole lot to get through tonight. This is really our big bumper Christmas episode. We're going to talk about the best gadgets and tech, but first of all, we're going to dive in and have a bit of a chat with Simon. Simon, you're the CEO of...
No, I'm one of the co-founders.
The co-founder.
We've got another CEO.
Okay.
Yep.
Of Mako Networks.
That's right.
Yep. And can you tell us just in brief what it is that Mako does, and then we'll dive into our discussion around security and other things that are sort of relevant for this time of year.
Sure. Mako effectively makes a system designed for small to medium-sized businesses to connect them from the internet, protect them from the dangers of the internet, both internal and external, and deliver services like content filtering, quality of service, and VPNs to those businesses. It's a centrally managed system managed from the cloud, and it consists of... two main parts, one being a range of appliances at a customer's premise and the other being a hosted management platform. Recently as the last 2 years, we've become the first network management company in the world to get a payment card industry data security standard certification. And so the largest growing part of our business is protecting card-present merchants from credit card fraud.
Awesome. We enjoy chatting with New Zealand companies that are doing innovative things and particularly doing that on the global stage. And I think that's one of the things that's really impressed us about Mako is, you know, just how innovative you guys are.
You're off to the US to do the NRA, which is it? You know, yeah, NRA, but that's
NRA.
It's the other NRA. The other NRA, which is what, the National Restaurants Association?
Yeah, that's right. Thrilling sounding trade show. but there's lots of free food and drink there as well as people that need protection from credit card fraud.
And is that one of the, I mean, we were talking about this off air, and I mean, I love this topic, so we could talk for ages. So Paul's going to have to control me today. But the payment side of things and this whole skimming thing that we hear about, do you want to sort of explain what skimming is to our listeners out there and go through what it means to New Zealand customers and stuff?
Sure. Well, there's a huge worldwide rise in credit card fraud and in particular skimming. And what skimming is a way for the bad guys to get your credit card information without you knowing about it, and then they monetize it. Most commonly what they do is they'll physically hack a payments terminal like an FPOS machine or a car park payment kiosk or anything that you have to put your card into for it to read its data. And as well, what they'll do is they'll capture that card data. The main things they're after are your primary account number, which is the main number written on the front of your card, and that's basically what either the chip or the magstripe does, is transfer that information into the bank's systems. And then hopefully they'll also try and capture your PIN number. Once they've got those pieces of information...
Hopefully for them, not for you.
Well, they don't even need your PIN number, really, to monetize it. It's
really?
Yeah. In America, for example, they don't use PIN numbers anyway. It's all signature.
Right.
But with PIN numbers allows them to get cash out. No PIN numbers allows them to buy goods online.
Right.
So they'll... First of all, they'll need to skim the data off the card, and they can do that by manipulating any device that the card skims through. It could be a door opener at the bank to let you into the ATM lobby, could be the ATM machines, it could be an FPOS machine.
And some of these are quite creative. I mean, they're like exact replicas of ATMs and all that sort of stuff,
isn't
it? Yeah,
exactly. So they'll even put overlays over an ATM so it looks exactly the same, but there's an overlay over the green sleeve that looks like a green sleeve, but it's as the card slides into an ATM, it actually reads the data off the card before the bank does. But the bank still reads it, so you still get your money out and everything works as normal. It's just someone's intercepted the data. And then they'll have a keyboard overlay over the ATM, and it's still pushing keys underneath. So the bank gets it, but someone's grabbed both those pieces of information. In a store, they'll... break in quite often, and then they'll steal or swap out the FPOS machines for ones that look exactly the same and still work the same, but again, they're intercepting the PINs and the primary account numbers. And what they'll do is typically that data that they're intercepting will be sent to a laptop sitting in a roof cavity or in a bin outside, and they'll stream it to that via Bluetooth or Wi-Fi. And after weeks or months, when they've grabbed enough information, they'll then go and usually sell it online to a third party. And it can be as the selling process can be broken down to as granular as they might advertise US-based Visa cards that have a balance of $20,000 or more, and someone can specify that that's what they want. Another party of bad guys will buy those numbers, and they'll then usually make blanks, so blank cards. And then they then might go and hit ATM machines in another city in another part of the world within a 20-minute window and withdraw cash. And the reason they do it all within a 20-minute period is the bank's fraud systems find it very difficult to detect an anomaly in that shorter period of time. There's a number of other ways that the data is monetized, but if you've got someone's primary account number and or their PIN number, you've effectively got their cash.
Is it physical? You mentioned they make new cards. Is online a big thing with these credit cards, or is it do they reproduce it for online or for physical media, like the physical cards themselves?
It's both. It just depends what the bad guys want to do. So there's two steps to monetizing it. The first person to monetize it actually sells the card data, and it'll be sold for it's a commodity. So the cards, depending on how many there are out there in cyberspace, the cards could be going for as little as $7 a piece to as high as $50 a piece. And then the next guys that buy those numbers, they'll turn it into more. It's like the rest of the world. It's capitalism.
Not listed on the stock exchange, though, is it?
No, stock exchange listing.
And for listeners that are thinking if this is a lesson in how to do it, that's not our intent.
Yeah, and so you mentioned the US, right? So everyone, we always read about that this is, in the US, they've had this KFC, I'm making this up here, KFC or blah, 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 have had this happen. KFC didn't have that happen. But is this happening in New Zealand?
Yeah, it's happening everywhere. The US has laws of disclosure that forces merchants to go public with stories of card breaches. Most of the rest of the world doesn't. So the majority of the stories that we read about all the stuff happening comes from the States because they have to talk about it. In New Zealand, it happens too, and with alarming regularity, but you don't have to talk about it. And if you're a merchant who's had a card breach and you don't have to talk about it, why would you?
Yeah, I guess it's not not a good thing for your brand, is it?
No, it's really bad. And it's bad for the banks, and it's bad for the credit card companies. It's just bad all around.
And I guess there's a few sort of different, scenarios as well in terms of, A, how people get the information, then B, how they then use that to, to generate a return. Mm-hmm. What about in a completely offline scenario? We've talked on this show. In fact, we've had recordings of some of the callers that call in from India and various parts of the world and say, hey, you've got a virus on your computer, or hey, I'm from Microsoft. And I came across a case last week, of an older gentleman that got duped by one of these scenarios, which, I was pretty surprised that they would do that. But I guess the fact that they make the calls, there's a percentage of people that they trick. And he thought he had got a great deal on, buying this antivirus software, and he'd given all his credit card details over the phone.
Yeah.
In a scenario like that, do you know what would be a typical outcome of how they use that?
Well, it's exactly the same as I just described. It's just another way of skimming the cardholder data.
So once they've got that, then
once you've got the data, you've got it.
Using whatever technique.
Exactly. So you can skim it by intercepting the card going into or out of a machine. You can skim it by getting someone to give you the numbers over the phone. You can skim it by putting up a fake website, advertising some really top value goods that people put their card data into the system, and then they've got it. So people should really treat their credit card data as cash, because it's just as useful. You use it just as you would cash, and it's really convenient for you and for criminals who've got the number.
The flip side is, though, in New Zealand, the banks have been, I would say, fairly generous with people who have got themselves into trouble. This case, that I heard of last week, I'm imagining that the bank will have actually probably picked up the tab. If these guys have gone off and pulled $5,000 or $10,000 off this chap's credit card, the banks in most cases tend to pick it up here. Now, I've heard of different situations, like in the US, where there's been internet banking type fraud, and situations where the bank doesn't pick up the tab and says, no, you lost $250,000 or whatever it was out of your bank account because you didn't have secure enough passwords. That's your problem.
Yeah.
How does that look in New Zealand and other parts around the world? Are we a bit lucky here at the moment? Or
it's pretty much the same the world over, because the card schemes, the main card schemes, Visa, MasterCard, Amex, Diners, they're the same everywhere. So unless a consumer has been grossly irresponsible or negligent, they're going to get their money back. The story's a little different with debit cards. With credit cards, you're using the bank's money. So, you know, you can refuse to pay. It's not actually your money they've stolen at that point. It's the bank's. With a debit card, it's your money that's been nicked straight away.
Right. So that's a different story. If you lose it off a debit card, it's probably gone.
It's harder to get back.
Yeah.
Whereas with the credit card, it's not your money that's been stolen in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
However, the banks are pretty lenient with giving people's money back because there needs to be a good faith in the credit and debit card system, or people will stop using them and start using cash. The real net result of increased card fraud is increased fees for using cards and for both the consumer in their annual fees, and also for the merchant in their merchant fees. They pay a percentage, of course, for each time someone uses a card at their stores, and those prices will go up, which means the consumer goods prices will go up.
Yep.
So you mentioned that obviously it's happened in New Zealand. Now, one of the ones that's publicly known is the ACC car parking.
Auckland City Council car park one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know we've got to be very careful talking around this, but what can you tell us actually happened and how they got caught and what was the implications of the whole scenario? Because this is a real scenario that happened here in Auckland.
And it was pretty frustrating for all of those who couldn't use their credit cards in the parking machines for about 2 or 3 years while they fixed it as well.
Yep. Yeah,
my car got nicked and got stopped. Card got nicked from that machine and got stopped as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
And same with Skip's, right.
So what can you actually explain to listeners that are from out of Auckland and overseas, what actually happened in here?
Well, what it looks like happened, and it hasn't, all the information hasn't come out,
correct,
some criminals from another country hacked the machines where people remotely pay, the kiosk machines at that car park building, put their card in and get their ticket paid for. They hacked those so that they were effectively skimming the card data. They were skimming your PIN and they were skimming your Magstripe data.
Is that because they were connected to the internet in some way and they could actually route into the system? Or do you think
they were on a network that was either connected to the internet or could be got to from another network.
Yeah, that was the way I understood it too. So it was probably a bigger picture than just the machines that were left open.
Oh, I think it was, but yeah. Again, I don't know, I'm guessing. But the banks spotted an enormous number of, or how these frauds are caught most often, is the banks see a lot of unusual activity on customers' cards, and they then go through and work out where the common places that all these cards with fraudulent use have been. And it didn't take them long to work out that it all came from that car park. The problem is the cards weren't, when they were first harvested, they weren't used for a period of time. So no one really knew, and whether or not they still do, I don't know, how long that hack had been going on before they started using the card data. Normally they'll try and use the card data within a matter of months so that there's not so many expired cards that they've got. But the longer it is, it's been sitting in there, the more card data they've got.
And how did you know that your card had been compromised through this situation? Because now when I look back, I can recall a call from the bank around at least one of my credit cards saying, oh, there's been a little bit of a issue. We think your card's got out there, so we're issuing you a new one. Mm. But they didn't tell me what it was. Mm. It may well have been in that time frame.
I'm in the same boat. They didn't tell me why. In fact, I was in the US at the time for work, and I was trying to rent a car, and the card wasn't working. My business card didn't work. And so I used a personal card, and then about an hour later when I was in the middle of a meeting, my bank rang me on my cell phone.
Okay.
I wouldn't have been the only person that had a card stopped while they were overseas, and it's a real hassle with, you know, if you've got hotels sitting on it and rental cars and meals and things, and all of a sudden you've got to start using a different card. You can't just pop down the bank and pick up a new one.
Yeah. I've been in a position of getting stuck with a credit card overseas as well. I can't remember what the scenario was, but it can be quite a few hoops to jump through to get that sorted.
Mm.
So we've got a question from online, actually. That people want to know about these internet-based FPOS systems. Good, bad, or ugly, and what are your thoughts on that? And they also put a second part in here. Should we be worried about credit cards being processed via public internet system?
Well, I'll address the first question first, I guess, which is, and I'm assuming they're meaning FPOS machines in stores that are connected to the internet. Now, those machines, in New Zealand, just before the Rugby World Cup, we went through a big upgrade to all the FPOS terminals to support EMV, which are the chip and pin cards. So most new cards these days have a chip as well as a mag stripe. So before the Rugby World Cup, all the merchants had to swap to new machines that that can read those chips. And at the same time, those machines can the replacement machines have Ethernet connections on them. So you can connect through to the payment processing end of things through a broadband connection if you want to.
Right, which can be a lot quicker. Right?
It's a huge amount quicker because the chip cards and the chip machines have they've got a lot of extra security in the system, but that also puts a whole lot of overhead on the transaction, and on slow old dial-up, it can make the transaction take up to 40 seconds to process versus you put it on broadband and it goes back to 2 or 3 seconds.
Yes. Wow.
If you're in a bar or somewhere where there's potentially queues of people lining up to pay, that magnifies itself over an evening or a day depending on when you're doing business, and it's a huge problem for those stores. So you'll find over time most of the merchants will migrate over to using broadband. But obviously there's a security risk in doing that, because if you're connected to the internet's connected to you, and you need to protect the environment those machines are in. That's actually what we do, is protect the merchants' network environments to the payment card industry specification. Our system does clever things like ensure that only FBOS terminals that are supposed to be there are there, so we stop the swap outs. That those terminals can only connect to the bank's payment gateway rather than shoot data off other places, and a whole lot of other clever things to do with automatically updating and firewall security and separating card data from non-card data and so on and so forth.
Excellent. That's great.
But if a merchant's following the payment card industry specification, then whether they're connected to broadband or using a phone line, it shouldn't matter to a consumer. But you've got to hope that a merchant's doing the right thing with their connection. At the moment in New Zealand, the payment card industry spec is not tightly enforced. It's beginning to be. In countries like America and the UK, where we also operate, merchants really don't have an option but to adhere to that standard. But by and large, not a difference from a consumer standpoint. What was the second question? I've forgotten.
Are you worried about our credit cards being processed via the public internet?
No, well, that was really
same thing.
Yep. So, yeah.
Okay, no, that's good. Now, were there any final questions that you had there, Brad, around the security picture? I think we were talking earlier, you had some
I got
things.
Loads.
Okay.
Obviously, we're a week out from Christmas, so the transactions on the system are going to go through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to, I suppose, your mum, your girlfriend, your partner at this point in time? What are the key things people should be watching out for when they're manually going into shops or doing anything online? What are sort of some of the key gotchas to, hey, just check this thing to make sure? What would you say?
Well, key thing about dealing with credit card data online is, one, make sure you're in what you consider to be a reputable online store before you put your card data into the system, and secondly, always have a glance up at the URL bar and make sure that it's a secure website with a HTTPS written at the front of it. Those are the two main things to do with online. Regardless of whether you're dealing with credit cards online or offline, treat your credit card like it's cash, because it buys things for you and it buys things for someone else who's gotten hold of it. With regards to buying things in store, theoretically, you're not supposed to let the credit card leave your hand. Now, that sometimes doesn't work in restaurants because people walk away with it. But if someone's walked away with your credit card, they can do what they want with it. And one of the most common places for card data to be swiped is in a restaurant. And they'll have a little, waiter or waitress might have a little card reader on their belt or in their pocket. And as they walk up to the counter, they'll swipe your card and they've got your data. So don't let it out of your hands if you can avoid it. And keep an eye on it. When a merchant in a store is swiping your card, they should only be swiping it once through the FPOS machine.
Sorry, it's very common when you go to a restaurant for waiters to walk, like they walk over to the tills. You know, that's
interesting.
So you're better just to go up to the counter and pay that way.
Yeah, it's a lot less risk.
It makes a lot of sense.
Wow, actually. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. That was just something just to think about. Mm-hmm. It's like, because I do it all the time when I go to a restaurant. I say, you put your credit card in the little black thing, and away you go.
Mm.
But and you never sort of really think, it's going up there. And they just hold it in their pouches or their waiting uniforms and stuff like that.
Yeah, there was a recent big bust in New York City with a whole scam throughout a bunch of restaurants where the waiters and waitresses had little skimming devices on their belts. And as they walked up to the counter to process your money, they just swipe it and you never see it. And a clever person can swipe it in front of you without you seeing it. So the chip cards are technically not supposed to leave your hand at all, and you'll notice on the FPOS terminals, the chip slot is in the front of the machine, yep. And it's designed so that the customer does the dip as opposed to handing the card over to a merchant to do it.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you when you were full flight, but that was just, wow.
Yeah, no, it's just treat it like cash and don't let it out of your hand. And a merchant shouldn't swipe it twice. They should. There's no need. They're only swiping it once for the data to go to the bank. If you see someone swiping it a couple of times into different devices sitting behind a desk, that's a little bit of a should be a bit of a wake up to you. Mm. And that sort of thing happens a lot in hotels. Hotels are another big credit card data risk. Particularly because not only do they have the option to swipe your card multiple times, but they also store your cardholder data on a computer system so that if you use the minibar or go to restaurants and things, you don't have to do it again. But you got to wonder, you know, are the systems that they're storing your cardholder data with, are they safe?
Yeah, that's always a real concern, isn't it? Mm. And I think that's probably something that's going to have to change in time, isn't it, the way a lot of those systems actually operate.
Well, the big move, so the payment card industry data security standard that's being pushed on people, as well as protecting or giving merchants guidelines as to how to protect their broadband-connected terminals, it also insists that you can't have any clear cardholder data stored anywhere on your network. And so there's a lot of work being done around tokenization, so converting the data into a useless token rather than actually being card data, or storing it off-site at a certified location, and banks will quite often store it off-site for the merchant. But really, there's no need for a merchant to store cardholder data anyway. They can get a pre-auth on a card and give it, not store it.
Mm. Okay. Oh, that's great. Well, really appreciate your time, Simon. We've enjoyed that. We'll head on with the show.
All right. If people want to sort of see you guys on the internet, what's your website, Facebook, Twitter, or anything like that? We can sort of keep a track of you guys.
Our main website is at makonetworks.com.
Yep.
And if you go to news.makonetworks.com, there's links there to Twitter and our Facebook feed. And I don't even know if we have a Facebook feed. We've definitely got a Twitter feed, and there's a WordPress feed and things like that.
Fantastic. It's been a pleasure having you in here.
Yeah, thanks very much. Yep. Appreciate it.
Well, that was good chatting to Simon. Now, we have played with and seen some really cool technology, gadgets, consumer electronics over the year.
A huge amount.
This is the episode where we get to sort of summarize and pick really our favorite things from the year and give the audience a chance to go out and do some Christmas shopping. Right, so anyway, talking through some of the biggest and best and smallest and fastest and
our top
ten, whatever the words are.
Yep.
Let's sort of go around and chat about some of those things. Now, Brad, you've been looking at some of the TVs recently.
Yes.
What's really your pick for the year in terms of the best out there?
So yeah, so my pick is the Samsung 55-inch 7000 series. It's the borderless range.
That's phenomenal, isn't it?
It's a stunning TV, and I mean, I think the board is about 2 to 5 mil. Would you guess around that range? Is it about 5 mil?
It looks a bit like a picture frame.
Yeah,
so you're probably talking, I would say, more like 10 mils, but it's
small.
It's very sleek.
And it's very thin. It's LED. You hang it up on the wall, which is stunning. And the picture quality is absolutely amazing. Now, these things are retailing at about $5,000. Now, I've seen them. I saw them on special about 5 weeks ago for $2,900. I think they're back up to about $3,300 in the stores. You had a
four five. I think I saw one for today. So I think that's probably your retail price. And you know, there is a potential to get them down a little bit. But that is really I would say that's the leading TV in the marketplace at the moment. And we'll talk about projectors soon. But that's really the top of the line. Now, the other one that I think it's worth looking for, because that also is a 3D TV, is the 6000 series, which is just the one step down, or the previous.
Yep.
It was their leading series going back sort of 12, 18 months. And the 6000 series actually still delivers a really good picture. And I saw today I think it was a Bond and Bond store that was specialing that in this particular store. And I don't know if it's in their price list, but this store was selling the 55-inch 6000 series for $1,999, which I think is...
Say that again, sorry?
Yeah, just un- $2,000 effectively for 55-inch on the 6000 series, and that's a lovely TV, and I think that one's 3D as well, so it's not bad. So TV wise, yeah, I would say those are really our picks at the moment. Now jumping across to projectors. Now we're in that sort of video space.
You've been testing a lot of projectors recently, haven't you?
Yeah. So I mean, you and I have both sort of been big fans of of the HD projectors for some time, and so I wanted to see what the next step up was. And there were two 3D projectors that we had a look at. So we looked at what Panasonic are doing with their AE7000, and also what Epson are doing with their TW5900 and TW6000. And I have to say that both the Epson and the Panasonic, the results were just phenomenal.
Now these are 3D, aren't they?
Yep. So they're great HD projectors. So I mean, if you want to watch a film, then in my opinion, what you see on a projector just blows away what you see on a TV.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's to do with the size. It just feels like being in a cinema. If you get that set up right and you've got a dark room, it just looks fantastic. Great for Xbox, even plug your computer in, whatever. It just looks great, particularly if you can put that up on a wall at 120, 130 inches. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, you do. You get that whole, it is like being at the cinema. You just need a bucket of popcorn and away you go.
Yeah. So both the Panasonic and the Epson, great products. There's a little bit of difference, and it's the sort of thing, if you're going to get into buying one of these for your home, then worth reading up some of the reviews and then take a pick, you know, based on what you're looking for, based on your environment and so on. One of the big things that I noticed really around 3D is that with a projector, you really need a pretty dark room for it to work because of the way the glasses work, and they're effectively shutting out, you know, the light from one eye at a time, so you can get that 3D effect. It effectively halves the brightness of the projector. Now, you don't get this with TV, so if you want 3D that you can just watch any time and doesn't matter whether your room's dark and so on, then go for the TV. That would be my recommendation. But the projector, once you've set it up and if you've got a room that you can dark out or it's night, looks phenomenal, the 3D.
Now, what's the price difference? Because you mentioned both Epsons and the one Panasonic. Can you remember roughly what the prices are? I mean, at a guesstimate, if you can't.
Yeah, so the Epson ones are starting under $3,000 now.
For a 3D projector?
For a 3D projector.
That's really dropped. I mean, I've got my Sony HD, and that's about $4,000 when I bought it about 2.5 years ago. So they've really dropped down. I mean, that's a 3D HD projector. That's really nice.
Yeah, so those prices have really come down. And this is a full HD projector. So, you know, bear in mind that what you're likely to use a projector or a TV for is 95 or more percent of the time at this stage is going to be 2D content.
Correct.
Very, very good for that. Awesome. But having that 3D option there in the background is great. Now, just a couple of things about those two projectors. I found that the Panasonic, which really is a really high end projector in terms of some of the features, really nice with you've got a lens shift, so you don't have to work too hard on your positioning of the projector because you can change where it points the image on the wall.
That makes a big difference if you're hanging it from the ceiling. From personal experience. If you've got that technology built in,
or even just, you know, I was just testing it on a shelf where I sit my projector, and my existing Epson allows me to adjust that. The Panasonic did the same, but the Epson I tried didn't have as much flexibility in those regards. It didn't have that vertical shift that I was used to in the other one. What it did have, though, really killer feature: wireless HD. So I have something that comes with the TW6000 comes with a device that plugs into your, say, your Blu-ray player or whatever your HDMI output is, and it pushes that full HD signal across the room to your projector.
That is worth buying. If you are setting up a cinema and you are investing a little bit of money, from a person that's gone through the pain of this and had to run, when he built his house, a massive HDMI cable, that is a killer feature.
Yep, and during my testing, I broke an HDMI cable,
Blu-ray player
caused potentially caused a bit of damage to the equipment. I'm not sure. I haven't had a chance to fully test it. That was the Panasonic, yeah. So,
oh, it was this Panasonic one.
Yeah, so the wireless, that's potentially good. I would say that will be coming out in other vendors' equipment in the future, but that's a really nice feature for Epson at the moment. All right, so off the projectors, tablets. Now, there's obviously a range of devices that are available out there at the moment. In the New Zealand market, the iPad has very much been the winner, but we've started to see a few other devices coming into the market.
Yeah.
You've even got, you know, Warehouse and the various electronic stores that are bringing in these $200, you know, in some cases under $200 type devices, real budget ones. But Brad, you've seen that there seems to be a bit of a sweet spot in that sort of $200 US point, and we don't have all of these products yet, but the Kindle Fire, from your perspective, is that the standout for you?
Yeah, look, I mean, if you do order it online, you can get it over here. It's one of the top devices out there, I think, for the price point, the features you get. The idea of a lot of these tablets is to consume information. So it's consume web, consume songs, consume movies, read books. The Kindle Fire is just mind-blowingly good. I had expectations that were quite high. It's exceeded those. I have an iPad, so before everyone starts going there, I've used Android. I've even used a Windows 7 Samsung Series 700, or 7 Slate. This beats them all. It really does. It's just bang for buck. It's just a great little device. It doesn't have all the things like cameras and everything else, but you know what? I don't want that in a tablet. I just want to be able to read books, watch movies, and surf the web and do Flash and stuff, and it just works.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, 2012 is going to be a different story as far as tablets, but yes, in terms of what's there now,
yep,
that's really a good value device.
I've really enjoyed the Samsung range of tablets, the Galaxy range.
Yep.
And I mean, they do quite a few different ranges. I mean, they do the different sizes, and I'm playing around mostly with the 5-inch tablet, which is more of a media device.
It's hooked to you at the moment, that
it
little
is,
white
I
thing.
I love it. I didn't think I'd actually be this enjoy this much of an Android tablet.
I've been trying to get that back off you, and it's just not working.
I think I lost it somewhere.
But no, I mean, look, for $200, though, honestly, you cannot complain. And hooking into the Amazon store and Amazon, all those services, it's just a night. I really hope it takes off. I mean, the rumor is they're going to sell about 6 million before Christmas.
Wow.
So it is. That's what they're projecting, and we've only got a couple of days to go till Christmas. So,
yep.
Yeah, definitely amazing device.
And here on the NZ Tech Podcast, we're big fans of setting up a US VPN so you get access to some of those extra services, and that really helps light it up, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Like anything, it's great to have in New Zealand, but when you plug it into the US, it becomes a whole new device.
Okay, so what else is in our top 10, guys? What about set-top boxes?
So we've actually got sort of two stories around this. Now, the Roku is phenomenal. I'm Roku'd in the house now. Paul was laughing at me before because I spent 9 hours rewiring my house again to get a USA network working, and I now have 3 Rokus working in the house.
And but the Roku's only available in the US, isn't it?
Yes, but you can buy them on Trade Me here. I have been keeping an eye on it because I remember you mentioning it, and I've also had a look around, and you can order them online. But pound for pound, if you put it up against the Apple TV device, which CNET did, and did a whole review, and they went through pretty thoroughly, and this guy is an Apple fanboy that reviewed it as well. Feature-wise, as in content-wise, the Roku's better because you're stuck with iTunes. Aesthetics wise, as in the way it looks, the Apple TV wins. It's just a beautiful, they make beautiful stuff. But for bang for buck, for what is it, 40, no, how much did you pay? $59.95 for yours?
Oh, the cheapest model was about 50 or 60
yeah.
US, and the top model's 100 US plus your taxes and so on. So yeah, definitely under
it's
200
just,
New Zealand.
Yeah, so CNET rated it, and they said, look, the Roku just won. It was just one of the top media devices out there. It's the size of a cigarette packet. Would it be that big?
No, it's smaller than
probably
that.
Probably smaller than that. It's just stunning. It's got HDMI, Wi-Fi, and yeah, it's brilliant little device. If you do have it, you do get content that works over here, so it's not like you plug it in, you have to have a USA VPN. You can get you know, television shows and everything that work, that you can, but there's other stuff that you can pay for online, but it's a brilliant device.
Yep, I'd have to say that it is worth having a look at what you want to do and how you know how hard a process you want to go through to get up and running. What I like about the Apple TV and also the Xbox is that they're available in New Zealand. They're available locally now. They're reasonably easy just to go out and get. And the you know, the Apple TV does a lot of similar things to the Roku, so I've enjoyed using that. And the Xbox has been a particular interest over the last couple of weeks because we've got this new dashboard.
Oh, yeah.
And with the US VPN, there is so much content that's opening up on there. Some of that is similar content that's on the Roku, but, you know, it's just really handy having that device that also works as a media center extender and a gaming device and so on. So I think you've got to have a look across all three.
The problem with the Apple TV is that you have to pretty much have an Apple ecosystem to really light it up. Whereas the other devices, if you're an Apple person and you buy an Xbox, it'll work for you. If you've got a Roku, it'll work for you. And the content with the Apple TV is you're limited to iTunes, whereas I do like the ability to choose what my content is.
I disagree, because one of the main thing, or probably the primary reason that I use these devices is to get Netflix,
yep,
a US VPN, and so any of these devices will do Netflix well.
But if you don't have a US VPN and you're in New Zealand, got to have the Apple ecosystem.
And that is the downside. I mean,
it's a big problem.
Well, there's
it's like the Roku.
But there's
like
a flip side to that, is that you can go and buy movies and content that you can't do off the Roku, because the Roku is designed for New Zealand.
I agree, but I'd rather have more choice than a lot of that stuff. I don't know. I've got all three.
Really, aren't you?
Sorry?
You've gone all open source on us.
Gosh, every week I get criticized from one camp. I can't win.
All right,
just going to be myself.
So Roku seems to be getting the stamp, although very hard to get in New Zealand. So, you know, certainly you can have a look at the other ones as well.
Trade me.
Other bits of tech we looked at, of course, were the Ford vehicles and some really cool tech in there. So I'm putting my stamp of approval on the Ford Mondeo Titanium. Awesome piece of technology. Great car from a safety perspective. The way all the Bluetooth integration worked was just phenomenal. Having gone back to my normal car and not having all the Bluetooth controls on the steering wheel and all the safety and the sort of automatic functions in there, it's taken me a while to come down again.
I have a vision. I have this vision of Paul Spain driving along, thinking he's still back in the Ford Mondeo with the auto crash device, going, "I won't crash." Bang! Oh, bugger! I'm not in the Ford anymore.
That almost caught me out the day after I returned the Focus, because I came to the end of traffic and I'm like, "La la la, this is quite sweet." Oh, that's right, I'm just back in my old 2004 Mondeo.
Well, he's parallel parking and he'll just let it go and it'll try and park itself. They have beautiful cars. I mean, I was telling people at work about this and they were just like, it is a stunning piece of technology in those Fords. It really is.
It certainly is. Now, top laptop, a little bit of debate around this, but...
yes.
You know, we've had a look at, you know, during the year, we've had a look at a whole range of devices. You know, Sony have got some cool gear, Samsung with the Series 9, the ThinkPad X301 that we had a look at. All of them are really good.
MacBook Air,
the MacBook Air. Yep. I mean, all very good devices in their own right, and quite different in terms of their focus.
Yes.
But, you know, what would you guys pick as your favorite for the year?
I definitely love the Samsung. The showpiece of the Samsung was to be able to pick it up on its corner and fling it around the, like it's a piece of paper.
The titanium
flexible screen. Yeah, although if you do that too much, the screen does
break. As our friends at Microsoft found out at TechEd.
Yes.
But, I mean, in terms of a very nice-looking laptop and a very robust laptop in that light range, I don't know if you can find anything better, to be honest. It just looked slick, and it was very, very solid. The only downside to it was having to get additional dongles to plug your Ethernet cables in and that sort of stuff, because, of course, being so thin, it didn't quite have a slot for an RJ45 socket or anything like that. But a minor thing to deal with in terms of being a traveller. I mean, if I had the money, I'd get one.
Okay. Brad?
I'm tired, and this is going to cause a bit of controversy.
Oh, here we go.
So I've got two. I really liked the Sony Ultra Thin with the battery, which gives you 15 hours and that one there.
Yeah, that was good. That was a good laptop.
And I like the MacBook Air.
What?
Yep. I put Windows 7 on it, and I would buy the hardware, and I'd put Windows 7 on it, because I don't like SNOM.
Have you bought one?
I can't afford one. That's the problem. So if someone wants to give me one, but if I had the money, I'm being honest, if I'd had the money, Apple make great hardware, I don't like the operating system because it just I've tried and I've got one at home with the but I love the hardware. So I'm tied between the MacBook Air and the Sony device.
Wow.
And I really, really am. And I put Windows 7 on it and it would just work for me.
I guess it depends what you use it for. My frustration with the MacBook Air is the lack of ports. And to do anything, you've got all these dongles and things hanging off it. Even to plug a monitor in, you've got to have another connection. And, I mean, that's the case, actually, with most of the MacBooks, including my MacBook Pro. And so you can't have one cable from your monitor straight into your device.
Yeah, but it depends on your working style, right? I mean,
I like to have a big screen plugged in. Yeah. That's just how I operate.
And I think at the moment, I've been traveling so much and I'm working from home a lot at the moment, just late at night. I'm finding that portability and that lightness of the Sony or the MacBook Air is just beautiful. But just rip out the operating system and put the 101 on there. That's mine. What about you, Paul?
Yep, I mean, in terms of as a consumer device, I think the Samsung Series 9 is the sweet device. In terms of a general all-purpose across the board machine, I bought the MacBook Pro and I like that.
Yep.
In terms of the business machine, it's a ThinkPad. So it sort of it really depends on what the requirement is.
Yep, true.
And so you know I'm pretty happy with the MacBook Pro and the ThinkPad in terms of my business machines. All right, so next on the list we've talked about TVs, projectors, cars, laptops. We've got to be coming to phones, right?
There's been some awesome phones released in the
last, 12 months or so.
Oh, this has been the year of the smartphone. Seriously. I mean, there's been so much. It's the whole new battlefield has emerged on the smartphone front.
Yeah, it's starting to emerge. I mean, and it started off the year with Apple, clear leader, right?
Oh, yeah.
Android's come in, knocked Apple off the pedestal. They're at 44% market share. I think they came out the other day. And again, depends which statistics you read. This is US-based only at the moment, not global. But, yeah, I just, wow.
And then, of course, you got Nokia that's partnering with Windows Phone now.
Yep.
So that's not a small player in the market space.
No, it's only 100 million phones.
Making a significant change to their platform.
Well, this has been a big bet from Nokia as the top mobile phone maker in the world, but their market share declining reasonably rapidly. They've had to pull out all the stops, and they seem to be with their new handsets that we've seen so far. The big issue is that we can't get them in New Zealand without jumping through the sort of hoops that we've been talking about for Kindle Fires and Rokus and so on. You've got to go through an import process or a parallel importer. But there seem to be a bunch of them in the country already, and they're looking really, really cool.
I know. I was actually using one again today.
What?
Yeah, I've got the one. I've had a go of the 800 series, the one with the solid black and also the one with the different covers on it,
Yeah, there's a cyan.
Yeah.
Or are you talking about the 710 model?
No, this is the 800 with the cyan at the back of it.
Yeah,
and,
okay.
It's just got me all flustered. The glass is beveled. The grip is beautiful.
Stylish.
It is just a really, really nice phone. I think this
we
is
can get the N9, of course, right now, which is virtually the same.
It is the same chassis. Right? You've even still on the ones that we've got in the office at the moment. It's still got the spot for the N9 front-facing camera, even though this model doesn't have it. They just covered it over, so it's actually the same chassis. That's how new they've really pushed a lot of these out so far, and it definitely doesn't have a front facing camera. Trust me, the people have pulled it apart. But they are absolutely stunning wow. handsets.
So I think we need to pick a phone from the three platforms kind of gaining attention at the moment. Android, I saw the new Samsung Galaxy Nexus a couple of days, courtesy of one of our listeners, Ben Clapp. Thanks very much, Ben, for that. The Samsung Galaxy Nexus. Now, this is a cool Android handset. It's the first one with Ice Cream Sandwich or yep. Android 4.
What do you think?
And, I rate it. It's a really nice handset.
Wow.
It's got a nice big screen to it. It's HD, the screen, so it's 720p, very, very high-res screen.
Wow, that's pretty slick.
Yeah, stunning. So definitely one to watch out for. Hasn't been officially launched here in New Zealand yet, But as far as handsets go, it's a goodie. It's nice to see Android 4 now out in the wild and actually onto a device. It didn't have all the skinning and so on that we've seen in a lot of the Android devices of the past. So it was actually just, you know, much more usable than having all these overlays and so on that have been common in a lot of the previous ones.
I think the from the hands-on experience I've had already, I think the Nokia is going to be, it's not a game changer, but it puts the Windows Phone platform on an equal with the iPhone 4S at the moment and the top-of-the-line Android devices. I think the biggest problem is at the moment is competing in that middle and lower tier, which we're seeing a lot of Android is playing really, really well. But from my limited experience, I think when that comes in, that'll be one of my favorites coming out. I've had a go of a few different Android phones, but yeah, I'm still leaning towards the Nokia at the moment, guys.
I'm going to have to put my hand up and say, look, Samsung for me, and across all the brands. Samsung Android, the Galaxy range,
yep,
and the Samsung Focus that I use personally.
The Windows Phone one, sorry.
I think Nokia's got some incredibly stiff competition with Samsung. I think everyone's got stiff competition with Samsung.
Samsung are really innovating across every space that they compete in. And, you know, in the last sort of 5 to 10 years, they've changed their focus to be a design-led organisation. And you can really see that starting to come through now. Yeah. In a lot of the devices. So, okay, so we've talked about Windows Phone, we've talked about Android. Of course, Apple's still out there selling an absolute truckload of phones. Yep. I've been using the iPhone 4S for the past few weeks, the 64 gig model. And I have to say, this is a really lovely piece of hardware and it works well. So, I mean, in that space, you know, Apple's really just competing with itself on the iPhone platform. But the 4S actually, you know, it's a very credible device. I know a lot of people were expecting there to be an iPhone 5, and that was sort of the expectation out there. Yeah. But in terms of a device, it's nice. It's a solid and robust device. It's got the Gorilla Glass, and one of the things that stands out is you've got that simplicity of having that built-in storage up to 64 gigs. So that's quite a good chunk of storage, and you don't have to be, you know, pulling SD cards in and out and so on, like on some of the other platforms. So no, I think it's definitely a solid option. Siri. Yeah, I think the jury's still out on that one, and we're going to have to come back to that with a little bit of sort of testing, because all of the platforms now have options for voice dictation and, you know, various voice control features, and none of them are perfect is the bottom line. But you know, they've all got something to offer. All right, that's that's the wrap up on smartphones. Now, a few other topics to jump into. Now, have we covered off our big favourites of the year? Is that everything? Are there any devices that we've missed, guys?
Oh, we could talk for hours, but no, we got wrapped up into 10, didn't we? We're trying to be good.
I think it sums up the year quite nicely.
What about the new Xbox interface? Well, how would that rank, the new Xbox?
Yeah, that's definitely up there as one of the key things recently, for sure. And I mean, it's certainly one of the newest things to come out.
I'm going to say not this year, next year perhaps. The reason why I say next year is from a Kiwi perspective, from us down here, it offers something slightly new, but doesn't offer us anything slightly great.
Unless you're using the US VPN.
If you're on the US,
the
you can
features.
Get into sci-fi and all those sort of channels that are quite cool. And I've been playing with the sci-fi channel and other bits.
It's nice, eh?
It's really cool. But until we can actually break through some of this international content barrier, I don't think the Xbox is going to be the wow thing from a Kiwi perspective just yet. Next year, I'm hoping it's going to be the wow thing.
Yep, no, fair comment. And the reality is that the bulk of New Zealanders aren't going to have a US VPN, don't have access to that. Those that are interested, then do check the blog section on the nztechpodcast.com website, because we do have the details there on how to get up and running with a US VPN. And, of course, that then allows you to start registering for things such as Netflix, US movie streaming through iTunes and Xbox Zune service and so on. So that is well worth looking at.
All right, quick fire news. Let's go, Mr. Spain.
Okay, so all sorts of things going on or announced and whatnot in the last few days. Internet Explorer, Microsoft are going to be pushing out an update for those that are still stuck on Internet Explorer 6. That's got to be a good move, doesn't it?
Well, they're doing it for across all platforms, actually. It's not just Internet Explorer 6. They're copying the Chrome model, and you will get, for instance, if you're on XP right now, you'll go to IE 8, unless you block it with, you say no, but they're just going to start pushing this out because Chrome did it right. They need to start doing it. You need to be on the latest platform for security and purposes, and they just people just click no because they don't understand what's going on. So it's a good thing.
Yep, yep, that's good. Now, there was some news recently saying that Chrome 15 is the number one browser in terms of market share at the moment, and that's partly because they've been pushing through the updates is that all of the Chrome users or the large majority are on one version, whereas, for instance, IE doesn't have so many users on an individual version because they're split between IE 7, IE 8, and IE 9. So that's I thought that was quite an interesting stat.
It's manipulating the statistics, isn't it?
Well, overall, IE is you know still has the lion's share of the market.
But Chrome's got the best security record.
But that's one point. But I think you know the point the was that in terms of an individual version that Chrome 15 had the had more than any other. So,
but anyway, look, that's out of date now because Chrome 16's out.
Well, that's true. So
it's out. So 15's out.
Those stats will be falling apart as we speak.
Wait, I've just checked.
Chrome 17 could be out.
Chrome 21. Sorry. No.
So Chrome 16's out for everyone out there. If you are a Chrome user, you'll get version 16.
Couple of little bits, and just jumping back onto phones. A couple of little bits of phone news. It came out last week that there's an SMS bug that's been found in Windows Phone.
Yep.
And if you get a particularly weird malformed email, it can actually crash your phone,
cause
your phone to reboot, and so on. I mean, you've got to have a really unusual message, and I don't think it's been documented out in the public what that would need to look like to actually crash a phone.
It's a text message with special characters in a particular way that does it.
Yeah. So
and it is quite specific as well. It's if you have a contact pinned to your live tile. So if I have you pinned to my live tile and you send me a malformed text message, that's where my phone falls apart.
Okay, well, that's going to be pretty unusual.
And it kills the message
hub. If someone was trying to crash your phone, then your mate probably wouldn't do that to you, would
they? Well, it only crashes the messaging hub, not the whole phone.
No, but if it's pinned to the front panel,
it can crash
the whole phone. So you've got this small window of opportunity to jump in there and delete the live tile before it locks your phone. So there's a little bit of trick.
You have to reset your phone.
I believe it's the same fault as what's also been on, I think, the iPhone as well, have had a similar SMS-type security feature bug.
Okay, the way that handles those strange characters and or whatever it is that
I mean, a lot of this
crash.
Is all licensed technology anyway, so it's the licensed technology that's caused that that introduction of the bug. So,
yeah. So, well, interesting. I got a letter from Vodafone in the mail last week about our Vodafone account, and we use the Vodafone Phone Assure service, which has been really handy. I must say, having smartphones within your care as an organisation or as an individual, there's always a chance that one of them is going to come to grief in some form, be it gets stolen or it gets dropped or you go swimming with it, right? So these are risks, and Vodafone for a long time have had an option to pay a monthly fee to cover that with some insurance. Now, their announcement, the letter sort of was highlighting a primary point that they're now going to have the option of replacing your handset with a refurbed one rather than a new one. And in the case that they do that, the excess actually drops down. So I thought, oh, that's rather good. And then attached was a new booklet with all the terms and conditions. Now, what we found from reading those terms and conditions, there are a couple of other gotchas that they've introduced. And it appears as though most of the changes only affect those who sign up for their Phone Insure service after the 5th of December 2011. So if you were signed up before then, you're usually okay. But there were two big changes that I noticed. One is that no longer will they be covering phones that have been sourced from suppliers other than Vodafone and Vodafone's retail channel. So in the past, if you brought in a fancy phone from a parallel importer or from overseas yourself directly, that would be covered by the Phone Insure service. So that's gone. The other thing that they've done is for smartphones, and I don't know why you would insure any phone other than a smartphone, but there is a different excess price or amount you have to pay per claim to be able to get a replacement handset for smartphones, and that's gone up. It was $125. It's gone up to $200. So if you're using this service personally or as a business, you need to be aware of this if you're planning to sign up for it. If you signed up already, it seems like that they're being reasonably relaxed and those changes aren't being forced on the older users. Yeah, it seems a little bit rough, those particular increases. My pick is that we talked on the show a couple of months ago or a few months ago about Vodafone not insuring the iPhone 4 and the 4S. Those phones are worth up to, what, $1,300, $1,400. Now those phones are included again. So probably that's part of the reason why they've had to bump up those prices. So make those changes, but worth being aware of. All right, we're really coming to the end of this one. This is our big Christmas and almost end of year episode.
It is, and we've obviously come from a lot of firsts. I mean, we're up to episode 46. It's been our first year in production, and we hit a lot of milestones along the way, haven't we, Paul?
We have. We've had some fun. I mean, we got a real surprise. Was it our third episode? Our second episode, we were surprised to hear that we were featured on iTunes, weren't we?
Yeah, that's right.
And we thought, oh, okay, we're just kind of nice. This little show, and someone's picked us up.
I think that's because I joined the show in the second episode. That's where the feature came in.
Oh, that quality went up. It's all about Skip.
But no, we did. We got featured.
The quality did go up, didn't it? Because that was the point where we moved into a radio studio and the production values, having Skip working on the production, working in a professional studio, changed it, I guess, from a sort of a bedroom style podcast to a bit more.
Okay,
of a,
hold on. We did not record this in a bedroom. I want that stated. We recorded the first one down
bedroom style.
Yes, I know, but I can see where this could go on air. So we recorded the first one in the Microsoft offices, the Xbox room, I think it was, or another room next door.
No, we trashed that episode and we re-recorded in another room. So there's one hidden episode somewhere in the
archives
that no one will ever hear. That was our first sort of trial run.
I'll find it, Skip.
Good man. We need this footage. Yeah.
But no, we've had a lot of firsts. For a New Zealand-based independent podcast, we have actually broken some milestones, haven't we?
Yeah, I think it was the third episode where we found we'd hit the top of the iTunes podcast chart for New Zealand. And that was a bit of a surprise because in most countries, when you look around the podcast charts, usually the number one is always a comedy or something like that most of the time. And so for a tech podcast to actually be at the top of the charts, I think that was good.
Yeah, and when we say charts, we were the number one podcast in New Zealand outright.
Yeah, across all the categories. So there was
kind of scary.
All the comedy things and, you know, your BBC and TVNZ type things and so on. So, I mean, that was a real, I guess, a bit of a surprise for us, but really pleasing. The other thing that we found when we looked back over the year was, you know, we hit that number one spot a few times, but also we seem to have consistently been sort of the top ranked dedicated New Zealand produced podcast. So, you know, a lot of times there might be one or two TV or radio type shows that have been syndicated into a podcast format that would come above, but in terms of just the regular dedicated podcast, we were consistently ranking well there. So,
and the number one technology pretty much all the time at the moment. So
that's been good. So a pat on the back to you guys. Great job.
Yeah, obviously we couldn't do it without the people listening to the show and downloading every week. And also, we want support for FY12 for the next year, don't we?
Yeah, definitely. And you know, definitely a big thanks to all the listeners. It's you guys that have been telling your friends and spreading the word. And we hope that you'll keep doing that. If you like the episodes as you hear them, that you'll put something up on Facebook or tweet about it. We do really appreciate that. And it's as that audience grow that we've been able to attract the interest of, I guess the Samsungs and the Microsofts and the Nokias and all the various brands that are coming to us and saying, oh, would you like to review this piece of technology? Ford, of course, with the various, you know, the couple of cars.
Apple
that
with their
loaned
phone.
Us. Yep. You know, there are a lot of people that have been, you know, very generous with their equipment and so on. And, you know, we've also started to see some of those vendors, and particularly Microsoft, with bringing us to the Worldwide Partner Conference. during the year, and also the upcoming Consumer Electronics Show. So, you know, we've had some good opportunities to cover international events. So, yeah, that's been awesome. And
we can't forget our guests. And we've had some phenomenal guests on the
show. Oh, yes.
Yes. Yeah. What can you say? I mean, we've been lucky. We've been spoilt with the people that have come along and the quality. I mean, it really shows what, you know, New Zealand always packs a good punch. And I think the guests we've had this year have been really, really good.
Yeah, well, I mean, we chatted to some really interesting people in the US, you know, at the partner conference. We had Mary Jo Foley, you know, who's a well-respected journalist and podcaster there in the US.
We've had the likes of Nathan Mercer from Microsoft, Paul Brislin, who's with 2Ands. We had Paul Bischoff
from
HP, GM of the Personal Systems Group.
Yep, Mitch Olson from Small World.
That was a good one.
He's really cool.
Of course, we've had our show friend Di Henwood and a few of them as well.
Yep.
It's been quite entertaining. And of course, those, Paul, love this. Those really talented kids from Free Range Robotics.
That was a good episode.
I love the robotic stuff, and those guys were cool.
They were very cool.
And, yeah, a few of the international guests, AMD, HP. So we've had, you know, various people, not just local, but it's been great being able to talk to, yeah, some really great locals as well. And I think next year we hope to have a lot more of that. We definitely want to keep the guests coming through, and we'll definitely want to put the word out also to those that are within the tech industry in some way. Feel free to get in touch. You know, drop us an email, feedback@nztechpodcast.com. If you'd like to be more involved, and it might be you want to fly us around the world to the biggest and best events, or it might be that you've just got some cool tech that you want us to have a play with and to give our opinion on. Hey, we're open to that stuff. We know that the audience is interested in hearing about the tech, so if it's relevant, we'll talk about it. If we don't like it, we'll say we don't like it, but you know, we'll be honest about our feelings on the products that come past us.
And if anyone wants to give us, you know, Ferrari Testarossas to test drive for a year, hey, you know, we're down with that.
Yeah, as long as you pay for the gas as well, though, hey. You know, we, you know,
it's not the gas, it's the insurance we need to make sure. But yeah, look, it has been an amazing year. I think we've been very lucky. We've gone from a very humble beginnings to now actually having a lot of technology we get to play with, and we want to continue that in FY in 2012. And I think there's a lot of new technology we want to start playing with. So yeah, please get in contact with us.
There is, and we mentioned CES before, the Consumer Electronics Show. That's kind of the big event of the tech industry each year, or one of the, well, it probably is the sort of the biggest really event, isn't it, on an annual basis. There are certainly other. There are others, but we're going to be there for the NZ Tech Podcast. So come January, we will be reporting our first sort of fresh recording for 2012 will be coverage of the Consumer Electronics Show.
Yeah, which brings me to sort of what's going to be happening over the next few weeks. So for the next 2 weeks, we're going to have a highlight show coming through. It'll be sort of the best of. We'll break it. Each episode will be the sort of the first half of the year and the second half of the year. And as Paul mentioned, in the first week of January, when he's over in Las Vegas, we'll be bringing Paul into the studio via Skype and doing a CES special broadcast. So it'll be kind of cool. And then hopefully around January the 16th, we'll be back into our regular rhythm again. So it'll be good.
Yep, I think 2012 is going to be a great year for tech and gadgets and electronics. There's all sorts coming through.
All right, everyone. Well, look, I just want to say Merry Christmas to everyone out there. Have a good Happy New Year, and we'll speak to you live on air in 2012.
Yep. Thanks very much, everyone, for listening in. And, of course, we look forward and encourage your feedback. Feedback@nztechpodcast.com if you want to drop us a line. Of course, we're on Twitter @NZTechPodcast and Facebook.com/NZTechPodcast. If you want to give us a Christmas gift, then hey,
like
us. We'll accept them gladly. But you know, hey, just maybe put a little note up on the Facebook page or something. So yeah. Thanks very much, guys.
See you. Have a good New Year, guys.
Merry Christmas.
Cheers.